good evening, everybody. Welcome back to our Three Ideas in 30 Minutes, a Parshas Korach edition here in America. I want to thank our very generous sponsors for sponsoring this week, as always, Dr. Michael and Marilyn Fedak, and gratitude for many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. We remain very grateful to the Fedaks for their very generous sponsorship, and as always, our learning should be an aliyah for the neshama of Esther Tila Bas Gavriel Pinchas, and I believe it's Gimel Tammuz tonight, right? Any Chabadniks here? Yeah,
yep.
Gimel Tammuz tonight. So the Yahrzeit of the Rebbe. So
that was last night.
Am I a night off? Okay. I was going to say I'm in Chassidish time. There's no Shkia. They can still daven Shachris. Okay, here we go. And of course, our winner tonight goes to Ed Reichenberg. Ed, you are the winner. Winner, hot dog dinner. Thank you for coming, Ed. We appreciate you as always. And again, I just want to clarify, the hot dog winner is a sign of endearment, just in case anyone misunderstands it. It is a celebratory tradition here at our Thursday night cheer, and you become very popular if you win. So, Ed, may this be the win. May this be the start of a good week for you. Okay, here we go. Idea number one comes from the Parsha. I saw this idea many, many years ago, but I'm applying it to the Parsha this week because I think it applies very well. And that is as follows. Of course, we know that Korach, Vayikach Korach, we just spoke about it in Shul a few minutes ago. Korach took, doesn't tell us what he took. So Rashi tells us, Lakach has Atzmo, he took himself over to the side. But it's still unclear what exactly. Okay, so Korach had a beef with Moshe, with Aaron. He was upset, he was jealous that Moshe and Aaron took the kahuna, they took the privileges for themselves. And Korach felt that they should have spread it equally amongst the people. Why is it that you, Moshe and Aaron, your lineage is any better than any of us? Kulam Kadoshim, we're all holy. Why should that be the case? Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu gets very frustrated because Dasan and Aviram come along and they say, maybe we shouldn't have left Egypt. Egypt was the good old days. Maybe you should send us back. And Moshe gets very, very upset. Vayichar l'Moshe Ma'od. Moshe becomes very upset. So he says to Hashem, don't pay attention to their mincha, to their sacrifice that they're going to bring, because Moshe says, I never took anything from them. In other words, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't know why they're complaining. And so essentially, Moshe challenges Korach ve'adaso to a throwdown. And everyone's going to bring, Vayomer Moshe el Korach, Pasuk 16, Moshe tells Korach, Ata v'chol adascha, hey, you lifnei Hashem, you have to appear before God, Ata v'heim v'aron machar. So you and Aaron, you're all going to come tomorrow, and there's going to be this fire pan and incense, and who's going to win, we're going to see tomorrow. Okay, and again, it's essentially a throwdown, an old-fashioned throwdown, to see who's going to come out on top. Here's my question. The question is very simple. Why do you need the word machar? Why did Moshe, if he wanted to challenge Korach, why didn't you challenge him right then and there? They have a duel. Hey, they're arguing over something. So why do they say, we're going to do the duel tomorrow? Everyone's there right now. Why don't they just do the duel on the spot? Why in Pasuk 16 does Moshe tell Korach, you have to appear before Hashem, hayu lifnei Hashem, you have to appear before Hashem, machar, you have to appear tomorrow. We see this word machar come up a number of times in Tanakh. So for example, if you look in Shmos, this is by the Chet Egel, when the Jewish people get afraid that Moshe Rabbeinu hasn't yet come down. And they go to Aaron and they say, Aaron, can you build for us an egel? Vayar Aaron, vayiven mizbeach lefanav, vayikra Aaron. So Aaron builds the altar, and he says, vayomer chag l'Hashem machar. He builds the altar, and then he says, tomorrow, we're all going to come and we're all going to have a festivity. Once again, that word machar. Why tomorrow? Why does Moshe delay it here? If you have a duel, if you have a showdown, just do it on the spot. Why does he say, we're going to do tomorrow, come back tomorrow? Why by Aaron in the sin of the golden calf? Once again, Aaron says, machar, we'll get to it tomorrow. We'll build the altar today. But tomorrow we're going to come and tomorrow is when we're going to really serve this God that we are creating. Again, why this word machar? So I want to suggest, and again, I saw this a number of years ago. I actually saw it from Rabbi Riskin in his Sefer on Chumash, not in our Parsha. I saw it on somewhere else. But I'm going to apply it to our Parsha, and that is the following. We know that it is human nature, that when you are in the thick of things, it is very hard to stop yourself. If you're really, really tempted by something, Maybe for some it's a piece of chocolate cake. Maybe for some it's a hot dog. Maybe for some it's whatever the case. If you are really, really tempted to do something, it's very hard to stop yourself. If you're in an argument with someone, and you know, like, physiologically, I don't even know how to describe it, but, like, your shoulders tense up, and you get really angry, and you know you want to say something, and you want to get in a yelling match with the other person, it's very hard to stop yourself. The number one tactic to stop yourself is buying yourself time, right? We've spoken about this in the shiur before, friction. I once read a brilliant book about friction, the power of friction. Why is it that Netflix and Amazon are so successful? Because what they did is they took away any friction. So you naturally just are going to continue going on. So when you finish one Netflix episode, you don't even have to do anything. It automatically goes into the other, so it becomes very addictive. Amazon, why is Amazon so successful? Because my kids go online, there's no friction. They click, 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 click. They don't have to pay anything, right? I get the bill later on, but there's no friction. It's all free, right? So there's no friction. My favorite is when they say, Daddy, you have a credit. So all I did was use the credit. I say, I use the credit because you spent on the credit card last week and I had to return it and now I got the credit back. Okay, but anyways, right? So all of these things are very successful. In fact, they've done studies. When they moved years and years ago, they were trying to get people to stop smoking. They moved the cigarettes from in front of the counter to behind the counter, which meant that all you had to do was ask someone, not really a big deal, but that one action, I think it was like it dropped cigarette usage 70%. Just by creating a little bit of friction, they found that at all-you-can-eat buffets. So all-you-can-eat buffet, so of course the temptation is you're just going to get up over and over again. So if you sit, you know, like those booths? So if you sit not on the outside of the booth, but the second person in, so you have to go over someone else, your chances of going back and eating again, drop dramatically. All because of a little bit of friction. So if you can create some daylight, some space in between your temptation, whether it's about food, whether it's about looking at something, whether it's about getting angry at somebody else, if you can just create a little bit of space, if you can create some friction that says, let me not react right now, I'll react a little bit later, then your chances of success grow significantly. And that's exactly what's happening here in our parsha. Moshe Rabbeinu is so upset at Korach ve'Adasso. And he challenges them to authority. He says, you're going to come. And there's going to be a test, and all of you are going to put your pans in your... And Hashem's going to create a miracle, and he's going to swallow yours up, and Aaron's going to be victorious, and it's going to show everybody that Aaron and I are right, and you're wrong. And the earth is going to swallow you up. But why does Moshe say machar? Because what's he hoping that's going to happen that night? He's hoping that that Korach's going to go home that night, and he's going to sleep on it. And maybe his anger and his resentment and his jealousy will subside a little bit, and he'll wake up tomorrow morning... Cooler heads will prevail, right? This is what we tell everybody. When you get angry at someone and you're ready to shoot off that text or that email, what do we tell you? Just wait until tomorrow, right? Put it in the old days you used to put it in your drawer, put the letter in your drawer before you mail it, and wake up tomorrow. If you still are that upset and still angry, then you can, and chances are what happens 9 out of 10 times, you wake up tomorrow morning and you realize it's just not worth it. I can't tell you how many, I have a whole mailbox of emails that I never sent, right? Rabbi Goldberg and I give each other chizuk. Where we read it just to make ourselves feel better. And then he says, okay, Rabbi Moskowitz, now put it back in your drafts and don't ever look at it again. Because when you wake up the next morning, you realize the fight's not worth it. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping here. He was hoping that if he could delay Korach, Korach would wake up the next morning and realize it's not worth it. Same story by Chet Egel, by the sin of the golden calf. The Jewish people are delirious with excitement to serve idolatry. Aaron gives him a little bit, he builds the altar, and then he says, guys, tomorrow we'll have the biggest party ever. What's he hoping for? Why does he delay it till tomorrow? Because he's hoping that by the time they come tomorrow, they won't be interested anymore. Maybe either Moshe will have come, or they'll say, you know what, it's not worth upsetting Hashem. We see the flip side in one other place, and this is one of the greatest sources. Sefer Malachim, Kings 1, chapter 19, right at the beginning. So the backdrop of this is Eliyahu and the false prophets of Baal. I think it was 400 false prophets of Baal. They come to Har HaKarmel, and they essentially also have a throwdown. And Eliyahu challenges them, and he says, whoever's sacrifice gets eaten up by God, that's the real God. And so first the false prophets of Baal, they put their sacrifice there, and all day long they're davening, nothing happens. All of a sudden Eliyahu comes up there. It's mincha time. That's why we say mincha is a particularly auspicious time to daven. It's mincha time. Eliyahu says basically one or two lines, rub-a-dub-dub, Hashem, please. Fire comes down from heaven, eats up his sacrifice. And everyone's like, Hashem Elokim, this is amazing. Which is, by the way, what we see at the end of Yom Kippur. We mimic this experience because there's this religious euphoria. The only problem was, there was this wicked woman named Izebel. Izebel, who is the spouse of Ahav, who was the evil king. And Izebel hears about this. And what does she do? In the aftermath, Eliyahu killed all of the false prophets. So Izebel hears about this. Batishlach Izebel malach el Eliyahu lemor. She sends a messenger to Eliyahu. Ko yasun Elohim veko yosifun kai ka'es machar asim es nafshecha. She says, tomorrow, I'm going to come and kill you. Why did you just kill him today? Right? Spoiler alert. If you ever want to, don't telegraph, you're going to kill the guy. Right? Why is she saying, I'm going to come and kill you tomorrow? Because it's the flip side of our equation. She knew that when everyone had this religious euphoria, they'd just seen the miracle of Eliyahu. If she came and tried to kill Eliyahu, what would have the people have done? Whose side were they on at that point? They were on Eliyahu. They were on Team Eliyahu at that point. They just saw Eliyahu perform one of the biggest miracles in world history. If she came to kill Eliyahu, they would have protected him. So you know what she says, Machar? She says, I'll come tomorrow. It's the flip side of the first two examples. Because by tomorrow, everyone's religious fervor from yesterday is going to subside. And so if she tries to kill him today, she won't be successful. But she says, you know what, I'll come Machar. I'll come tomorrow. And if I come tomorrow, then they won't care anymore. So you see both sides. On the one side, it means that sometimes we shouldn't react in the moment. If you're angry at someone, if you're upset at someone, if you want to shoot off a text or an email to someone, sometimes it's better not to say, sleep on it. It's good advice for a marriage. It's good advice for your children. It's good advice for relationships. You don't have to react in the moment. Machar, delay it a little bit. You want that piece of chocolate cake? Get up, walk around the block, come back, and see if you can control yourself then, and you'll see it's much easier to do it. If we buy ourselves some time, we're much more successful. On the other hand, that word machar, like in the case of Izebel and Eliyahu, can be dangerous for us. Because if we don't take the opportunities when they present themselves to us, we could lose the religious fervor altogether. Right? We call it the day after Yom Kippur. Every night after Yom Kippur, you come home and you're on fire, and the Eila, Rabbi Goldberg, and screaming and crying. If you don't tap into the commitments you made right then and there, you know what's going to happen tomorrow? By tomorrow morning, all right, I'm already 5 minutes late to shul again. Oh, I didn't really mean that, God, yesterday. That was just because Ne'ilah. So machar can work in both directions. The delay can be helpful, but the delay can also be hurtful. We see both examples of that. But now again, we see in this week's parsha why Moshe says machar, because he's hoping that Korach in the delay will come to his senses. When Korach does not, that is when the earth opens up and swallows him up. There's another source it'll be a bonus, but I don't want to run out of time. Okay, page number three. This comes from Weinfeld, Kapolsky, of course, the Sefer, by his Rebbe, Rav Weinfeld, says something very beautiful here. Okay? Why does Korach choose to confront Moshe here? So, that's the question. Not necessarily chronological. So he says on the bottom of it, this is so, why did Korach wait until now to challenge Moshe? The appointments he was complaining about, in other words, Moshe and Aaron, happened much earlier, as the Ibn Ezra notes. So why did he not protest then? Right? So let's say we even understand why Korach is upset right now. But he should have been upset a lot earlier. Right? This isn't our first rodeo with Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron have been in leadership positions for a long time. So if he was going to get angry at them, he should have gotten angry earlier. Why does he specifically get angry now? So if we turn to page number four, he writes the following. He says, the Ramban writes that up until this point, Moshe had been an extremely effective leader. Think about what Moshe did. He took the people out of Egypt. He performed lots of miracles. He split the sea. He received the Torah. He got forgiveness on behalf of the Jewish people after the golden calf. That's a pretty solid resume, right? For a heck of a lot better than our president's been doing the last few days, right? But that's a pretty solid resume for a leader. If Korach came and challenged Moshe, what would have happened? Nothing. The Jewish people were in love with Moshe. He was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Splitting sea, receiving the Torah, getting out of jail free card, miracles. That's pretty good resume. So if Korach had come then, nothing would have happened. So what happens now? Of course, what happens now is last week's Parsha. Bless you. After last week's Parsha, Parsha Shlach, when the fateful spies went into Israel and they came back with their nefarious report, and God says, I'm punishing you 40 years in the desert, you're all going to die. And Moshe tries to intervene on behalf of is Moshe successful or not successful? Moshe's not successful. He can't pardon the Jewish people like he did at the golden calf. So finally, for the first time, there's a kink in Moshe's armor. Korach seizes that. If you look in the underline, Korach sees the opportunity afforded by the potential dissatisfaction that Bnei Israel had with Moshe's leadership at the time and decided to stage the upbringing. Okay, that's somewhat of a famous idea. Listen to what Rav Weinfeld does with this now. He says an important message to learn is that a leader can make a mistake. Korach makes an assumption. Korach erred because he thought that a leader must be infallible. He concluded that since Moshe erred, he was no longer worthy of being a leader. Right? You understand the calculation that Korach made? Korach assumed that once Moshe makes a mistake, or once Moshe is not able to save them, at that moment he's no longer an effective leader. Because leaders are deified. Leaders have to be infallible. And so Korach sees that. He sees that Moshe makes a mistake, and he says, ah, everyone's going to understand that you can't have a leader that makes a mistake. And so therefore, on the spot, he comes and he challenges Moshe Rabbeinu. That, of course, is the wrong approach. Because if you look on the next page, page number 5, despite the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu may have erred in sending the spies, he remained the leader of Bnei Israel and the greatest of prophets. Moshe explained to the Jewish people that other decisions, such as the ones that Korach were complaining about, were not his own, but were matters that Hashem directed him to perform. Even, okay, dot, 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 go to the end. Therefore he says, not everyone is a leader of the nation, but there are still lessons we can draw from this. A person can be a leader of their family, or at least a leader of themselves. In other words, the same way Moshe was a leader of the Jewish people, and he didn't have to be perfect. He didn't have to be infallible. He didn't have to be deified, but he was allowed to make a mistake. And despite his mistake, he was still able to be a leader, says Rav Weinfeld. That applies to every single one of us. None of us are perfect. And whether you're a leader in your family, a leader in the community, a leader at work, don't assume that you therefore have to be perfect. Because you don't have to be perfect. You're allowed to make mistakes. And even after your mistake, you're still allowed to be a successful leader. He says the following, page number 6. He says, yet sometimes the various forces within us do not cooperate. We lose control and we feel like giving up. The most dangerous part we speak about all the time in this year is that after your mistake, you say, what's the point? If I've made the mistake, if I'm only the totality of my worst moment, then what's the point of trying at all? That's the worst thing. The lesson we learn from Moshe is that true leaders never give up. Even with all the setbacks, he still managed to create a people like no other. Winston Churchill once said, the definition of success is going from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Still, one would hope that the failures should at least be different failures. One should not repeat the same mistakes over and over again, but one must keep on marching forward, trying different techniques to succeed. And so whereas Korach assumes that because Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake, he was no longer worthy of being a leader, the Torah comes along and says the opposite. We never deify our leaders. The Torah goes out of its way to point out sometimes the flaws and the imperfections of our greatest leaders. Why? Because to show us that if they kept on marching on despite the mistakes that they made, so too each one of us can do the same thing. Moshe Rabbeinu never gave up. And as Winston Churchill said, success is going to fail without losing enthusiasm. That applies to us. So whether it's in davening, whether it's in learning, whether it's in dieting, whether it's in exercise, whether it's in a relationship, even if you made a mistake over and over again, obviously you have to improve and you want to grow, but never lose hope as a result, but continue to push yourself and continue to strive, because the worst thing you can do is to lose faith in yourself. Korach had the inappropriate calculation and assumed that once someone made a mistake, it puzzles them. It negates them from being able to take on leadership. And that's why he challenged Moshe right now after Parsha Shlach, but he made a fatal error, not realizing that even after Moshe made this grievous mistake, nonetheless, he was worthy of being the Jewish people. And therefore, I think it has a beautiful application to every single one of us as well. So idea number 1 came from Machar, tomorrow, for good and bad. For good, because if we delay our impulses, we're less likely to succumb to them. For bad, because if we have something we want to do religiously, don't wait. Do it right now. You got to grab the bull by the horns. Idea number 2 was Rav Weinfeld Leaders can make mistakes and still be leaders. Each one of us are a leader, and therefore we should not shy away from our mistakes. We should not become deterred by our mistakes, but we should lean into them and be willing to grow from them. Okay, idea number three comes from Sefer Machsheves Nachum. Says something so beautiful. I never saw this before. It's a very simple idea, but I think a very deep idea, and I think very, very relatable to every single one of us in our own lives. Again, Vayikach Korach, we come back to the beginning of the parsha, and Korach took. There's a word for it in the English language. It's escaping me right now. When it doesn't tell us what it took. Someone here, my mother's going to be, what?
Transitive
verb, correct. Thank you. I should have known that. Mom, I'm sorry, I apologize. Even with all that Maimonides school education.
That's the list of oratory, apologize.
I'm not perfect. There you go. See, I wanted to lead by example. And as my family will say, I lead by example. Maybe a little too much in this regard. Okay, but Vayikach Korach doesn't tell us exactly what he took. Again, Rashi, we said at the beginning, Lakach es atzmo, he took himself. We said in Min Chamara, Vayikach Korach, what was the problem? Maybe it's not that he took anything, but that it was descriptive of him. Vayikach Korach, Korach was a taker. And when you go through the world with the prism of what can I take instead of what can I give, that's a very dangerous way. It's a very dangerous way to enter into a relationship, into a marriage, when all you want to do is take, 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 never ends up in a positive way. But listen to what this Sefer, Machsheves Nachum, writes. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Vayikach Korach, what did Korach take? Shelakach mekach ra la'atzmo. Which essentially means that Korach assumed the worst about himself. When Korach had two options of looking at himself, one with the glass half empty and one with the glass half full. Korach always looked at himself with what we'll call low self-esteem, with the glass half full, half empty, half full, half empty, half empty, thank you, sorry, half empty. Korach always assumed the worst out of himself. And the problem is that when you don't love yourself, when you don't have a healthy self-esteem, you know what you're also incapable of? You're also incapable of having meaningful relationships with other people. If you're always beating yourself up, if you're always beating yourself down, if every time you make a mistake, you beat yourself up, if you look at yourself and you have a very low self-esteem and all you see is the worst in yourself, it's impossible then to have healthy relationships with another person. And so therefore, he says, the foundation of everything that happens with Korach and Moshe and Aaron, all of his jealousy, all stems from Korach's essentially low self-esteem. He thought very little of himself. And therefore, when you think little of yourself, you always feel challenged by another person. You always feel like the other person's out to get you. That's when your ego, you feel like you need to overcompensate with your ego, we spoke a little bit about last week. And so therefore, he writes, what does it mean, shalakach mekach ral atzma? That he always assumed the worst out of himself. Says the Sefer Machsheves Nachum, nearly dahainu shehichzik et atzma ligroa vera. He always assumed, I'm at page 7, he always assumed the worst out of himself. Umizeh nafal atzmutz. And that led him to be a little bit sad, a little bit depressed. Vizeh garam kol hara shehivi al atzma. And the second you feel bad about yourself, and the second you fall into that depression and that sadness because you only see the worst in yourself, then how can you aspire for greatness? How could you have ambition to take new things on and to think that you're capable of great things if you think very low of yourself? And so it happens as a domino effect. I see this all the time, by the way. First, a person thinks lowly of themselves. They feel like they're unworthy. They feel like they're, again, the subtotal of their greatest mistake and therefore defined by that mistake. And then what happens? They feel bad about themselves. And then when you feel bad about yourself, what impetus do you have to try to improve because you only see the worst in yourself and you feel bad about yourself and that constantly drags you down? Ki atzus goram l'machlokas. And then when you feel bad about yourself and you see other people succeeding, so you have two options. Either you're going to push yourself, or what's the easier thing to do? Knock the other person down. Because if the other person rises up and I am falling down, I feel very bad about myself. Because now there's a gap between us. And he is my mirror. I see what he's able to accomplish. I see what I'm accomplishing, and I feel very bad about myself. So I have two options. Either I can challenge myself and say, why don't I rise to his occasion? As the Gemara says, kina sofrim tar b'chachma, which essentially means that there's a healthy form of jealousy. That if you see someone who's succeeding in an area, there's a healthy jealousy that says, you know what, if he can do it, I can do it also. There's no reason he can do it and I can't do it, right? But the other way, and unfortunately someone with a low self-esteem, often this is the default. The other way is, if I can't challenge myself to grow, to become that person, then I'm going to knock that person down. And if I knock that person down, then they're not so great anymore. And if they're not so great anymore, well, then I don't feel so bad about myself anymore. And so there are two ways to make yourself feel better. Either to actually aspire, or to knock the other person down. He writes here, what happened with Korach was, because Korach had such a negative view about himself, the only thing he could do was knock Moshe and Aaron down. And that was the whole source. That was the whole impetus for the Machlokes. It all stemmed from an unhealthy relationship that Korach had with himself. We recorded behind the Bima with Yaakov Danishevsky. I think it's coming out next week. Yeah, this week was Dovi Neuberger. Next week, it's coming out. So Yaakov Danishevsky has a beautiful book. He writes a lot about attachment theory. His whole thesis essentially is that everything comes down to relationship. That what human beings crave more than anything in life is relationships. For no point, right, we live in a world of relationships with transactions. So what do I want from you? What do you want from me? That kind of defines our relationship. He says, no, people crave connection in a relationship that's not defined by any transactions, but just to be in a relationship with another person is what gives life meaning and purpose. And part of the challenges that the youth in our generation are facing, because the relationships are online, they've lost that ability. Right? And obviously, what he's done is taken this whole science of attachment theory and is applying it to Hashem. Because ultimately, that's what we want in our relationship with Hashem. We want a relationship with Hashem. We want a connection with Hashem. Part of why we work on interpersonal relationships is because we can master them, then I can also learn how to have a relationship with Hashem. If I can't have a relationship with you, if all my relationships are toxic with my spouse and with my children and with my friends, then how do you expect me to have a healthy relationship with Hashem? So part of why we work on our relationships with each other is because they're almost the platform to understand a relationship with God. Okay, now obviously it's different, but there are many, many similarities. Okay? What's the problem with all this? And we speak about this a little bit on the podcast. The problem with all this is that before I can have healthy relationships with other people, I need to have a healthy relationship with myself. And that takes a lot of hard work on my part. So sometimes in an unhealthy relationship, it's the other person's fault. But sometimes it's because I have contributed to the unhealthy nature of that relationship. Maybe it's a low self-esteem. Maybe it's a negative view of myself. And because of that, I always look at the relationship in an unhealthy way that's going to breed jealousy, that's going to breed contempt, that's going to make my ego perhaps feel like it's being challenged, and all of that. Think about how many fights stem from this idea itself. And so therefore he says, "Vizeh garam kol hara shevi al atzmo." The source of everything that happens in our parsha was psychology. It was that Korach had a bad view of himself. He had a low self-esteem. Ki atzos gorim l'achlokas. And the second he feels bad about himself, it's easier to knock Moshe and Aaron down. V'lachein siva lanu. And therefore, the Torah commands us, Mishnah and Perkei Avos, Ethics of Our Fathers, chapter 2, verse 13, Mishnah 13. Al ti rasha b'fnei atzmacha. The rabbis go out of their way to say, don't be evil in your own eyes. Don't be wicked in your eyes. You might make mistakes. You might do the wrong thing sometimes. You might fall short. You might be imperfect. But the worst thing is to lose faith in yourself, to view yourself as a wicked person. Because the second you view yourself as a wicked person, you're never going to change. Why would I grow if I'm a wicked person? If God's given up on me, I'm just going to give up on myself. And once I'm given up on myself, I'm going to see everyone else thriving and succeeding. And I'm just going to want to knock them down because that's going to be a lot easier. And so therefore he says, that's what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Al ti rasha b'fnei atzmacha, don't be wicked in your eyes. Kedei shelo yipol ha'atzos chas v'shalom, because if you're wicked in your eyes, then you'll feel sad, you'll feel inadequate. And if you're sad and inadequate, how can you have a relationship with someone else that way? And so sometimes we have to look inside and do the hard work with ourselves of understanding, why is it that I feel that way? And why is it that my ego feels threatened? And why is it that I'm jealous of that other person, seeing him succeeding? The hard conversations that you have to have with yourself. You got to look yourself in the mirror sometimes. But sometimes it's those hardest conversations that will open you up to the most meaningful relationships. And so we saw three ideas in a very short 30 minutes. Idea number one was Machar. Why does Moshe wait until tomorrow? Because he was hoping that in the interim, Korach would come to his senses. The lesson from that we should all take is, before you send that email or that text, just wait a little bit. Come back tomorrow, see if it's still important before you send it. I guarantee you, 9.5 out of 10 times, you won't end up sending it, and you'll save many relationships along the way. Idea number two was the timing of this dispute. Why does Korach wait until now? He saw Moshe made a mistake. He says, leaders have to be perfect. Moshe, if you made a mistake, you can't be perfect. We learned that that's not the case. A leader can be perfect, imperfect. They can make mistakes. They can fail. But they have to keep pushing forward. That is the true test of a righteous person. Idea number three comes from Yikach Korach. Again, the Gemara says, Shalakach Mekach Ralatzmo. He took a bad view of himself. That's what he took. It was internal. Because he viewed himself in such a bad way, it caused such destruction in his relationships around him because he became jealous and because he felt that it was easier to knock the other person down. And everything that happens in our parsha was all because of Korach's low self-view of himself, low self-esteem. Sometimes we have to be willing to look ourselves in the mirror and really ask ourselves some difficult questions. But if we do that, it can open us up to the most beautiful relationships. With that, I wish everyone a good Shabbos.